the January calendar, 96-2244-CR, State v. Kevin P. Sullivan, representing Mr. Sullivan, Stephen Phillips, Assistant State Public Defender.
Good afternoon. My name is Stephen Phillips, and I represent Kevin Sullivan, the defendant appellate petitioner in this case. Mr. Sullivan was convicted of punching his girlfriend, Diane Bonham, during an argument at her house in October of 94. After initially reporting to the police that Sullivan had punched her and restrained her, Ms. Bonham almost immediately reported to the district attorney's office that these accusations were false, and continuing with that recantation, testified at both Mr. Sullivan's
preliminary... Is that before she called 911, or who called?
She reported... It was reported to the police immediately after this incident. She did accuse Mr. Sullivan of this, and then the next day, she contacted the district attorney's office, indicating that this had not happened, as she had initially reported. She continued to testify at the prelim that Mr. Sullivan had not intentionally punched her, and she testified that way at trial as well. Her testimony was essentially that the injuries that she had received were caused accidentally during the argument with Mr. Sullivan. What this appeal involves is the state's use of other acts evidence at Mr. Sullivan's trial. The trial court permitted the state, over the defendant's objection, to elicit testimony from Kevin's ex-wife, Ruth Sullivan, that more than 2 years before this incident with Diane Bonham, Mr. Sullivan had gone over to his ex-wife's house, had wanted to talk to her. She refused to talk to him. He ended up yelling at her, calling her names, threatening to beat her up. And eventually a neighbor was summoned. He called her a name as well, threatened her, and eventually the police came and arrested Mr. Sullivan. Now, at first blush, perhaps the evidentiary issue in this case would appear to be a somewhat run-of-the-mill issue, the type of which trial courts deal with every day throughout the state. I guess what makes this case important is the Court of Appeals decision, where Judge Nettesheim, in quite an extraordinary line of reasoning, indicated that under the current case law, evidence which shows nothing more than a person's propensity to commit the type of act with which he is charged is admissible. And this despite this court's landmark ruling of Witte versus State more than 30 years ago, despite Rule 904.042, which specifically says that evidence which shows this character trait is not admissible for this purpose. The Court of Appeals reached this conclusion by determining that Witte and 904.042 were no longer being followed, and principally relied on some of this court's decisions in another context, or perhaps I should say a more narrow context, that involving other acts evidence in the sexual assaults of children. What this case squarely presents then, based on the Court of Appeals decision, is the question of to what extent Witte and 904.042 mean anything anymore, particularly regarding the prohibition against the introduction of propensity evidence. Now, I've argued in my brief that Witte has not been overruled, that it's still good law, that it shouldn't be overruled now, and fortunately, I understand the state to be concurring with that position. So I won't repeat those arguments now unless the court has questions about that. While I believe Judge Nettesheim was wrong in his conclusion that Witte had been overruled and is no longer being followed by this court, I think he was absolutely right in one respect in his opinion, and that is that this case presents a textbook example of other acts evidence being used simply to establish one's character, one's propensity for committing a similar offense to that which is being charged. I don't think there's any question that this evidence had but one purpose, and that was to show that Mr. Sullivan was the type of person who mistreats women. He gets in arguments with them, he calls them names, he belittles them, he threatens them, particularly when he's intoxicated. He threatens to beat them up, he attempts to control them and domineer them. The DA's purpose in getting this evidence in was to establish that, well, if Mr. Sullivan acts this way towards women, it's more likely then that he acted this way towards this particular woman, and it's more likely that this happened, as the state was alleging, that Mr. Sullivan punched Ms. Bonham, and not that the injuries that she received were caused accidentally.
Mr. Phillips, didn't Ms. Bonham take the position at trial and also at the preliminary hearing that her injuries were a result of an accident, that she had basically tripped or fallen, I thought it was into a dresser or something like that?
Exactly.
Wouldn't this evidence then be appropriate in regard to showing an absence of accident or mistake?
Well, that's the state's position on this, and essentially, I think we're getting at two particular exceptions that are enumerated in 90402, intent and absence of accident, which, at least in this case, are virtually identical. It's the same concept, really. And my point is that when you're talking about the, for shorthand purposes, I'll just refer to the intent exception, that exception is based on what is called the doctrine of chances. And basically, that's a common sense notion, or maybe even a statistical probability notion, that the more often a similar event results, a similar event ends up causing similar results, the less likely it is that the results are attributable to chance. In other words, that the results must have been intended. The problem with the application of that doctrine to this case is that these two incidents weren't all that similar, number one, and number two, they certainly didn't end up with like results.
Well, let me ask you factually, as I understood the testimony of the victim at the trial, it was that the defendant did not cause any of these matters. It wasn't a matter of whether he accidentally caused them or he purposely caused them, it was that he didn't cause them at all, isn't it?
Well, yeah, although she was asked the question so many times that her testimony was not altogether consistent on that.
Well, the reason, let me tell you the reason I'm asking the question, and you go on to answer it. It seems to me that 90402, when it says lack of accident, what we're looking at is if a defendant is accused of an offense or an act, and you have to look at the mens rea or the intent, the mindset of the defendant, you look to see whether it was an accidental thing or whether it was intentional or negligent or whatever it was. And if the defense in this case is either he did something or he didn't do something, as opposed to he did something accidentally, as opposed to purposefully, and I guess what I want to know from you in the facts is, was part of the case whether or not he accidentally injured her, or was it, was that in the case at all? I mean, was that part of the theory, is the defense theory, is that he may have done this, but he wasn't intending to cause a battery or intending to harm her?
Well, the reason that I say that the testimony was a little bit ambiguous was that on a couple of occasions, Ms. Bonham said that she couldn't be sure whether Mr. Sullivan's hand actually caused the contact with her, or whether she caused the contact with Mr. Sullivan's hand or chest or whatever it was. She wasn't sure. And to the extent that the state, at least, was arguing that, well, it was Mr. Sullivan's hand that caused the contact, they also had to prove that that was done intentionally. And I guess intent, particularly when battery is the charge, intent is always going to be part of the case.
Let me ask you about the tone of the defense in this case in terms of her cross-examination, maybe closing arguments. Was that part of the argument at any point of the defense that he, even if he caused this, that it was not intentionally done so it's not a battery?
No, I believe the defense's position was more absolute, that he didn't cause it, that she suffered the injuries either in the fall against the dresser or in the subsequent attempt to flee from the house when she drove through a ditch and hit her head on the steering wheel.
So the defense in this case was not accident?
No.
Mr. Phillips, let me ask you something else. It's my understanding that instruction 275, the cautionary instruction, was given, and that when the trial judge gave that cautionary instruction, that he covered more than intent and more than absence of mistake or accident, that he covered, if I remember right, motive and knowledge and credibility of witnesses. Was there any objection to the broadness of the cautionary instruction?
No, and I think the reason for that is because the trial court's original ruling was that this evidence comes in for all of those purposes. The instruction itself was consistent with the trial court's motion ruling that, in fact, the district attorney had argued that it's admissible for motive, intent, knowledge, credibility, you know, all those other things. The instruction just tracked the trial court's ruling. Now, I don't understand the state to be defending the trial court's ruling, at least with respect to motive, credibility, and knowledge. I think they're conceding that just doesn't fit the facts of this case. My problem isn't so much with the instruction, but with the trial court's ruling. In other words, the problem here is in admitting the evidence. And if the evidence had been excluded as it should have been, we wouldn't have needed any curative instruction. Well, the instruction that was given doesn't really cure anything, because it tells the jury that it can consider this evidence.
Are you troubled by the fact that it tells the jury that it can consider the evidence for reasons beyond what the state now says would be appropriate?
Sure, I'm troubled by it, but that is not the basis for our argument here. And as you point out, there wasn't an objection on that ground. The defense, you know, argued initially that this didn't come in under any exception to 90404. So it wasn't like it should only be admitted for a limited purpose and don't give the jury the rest of this instruction. The defense argued that it shouldn't have come in at all, and I believe that argument is correct.
Now, I understand that your position is this shouldn't have come in, and that it, when it did come in, it's prejudicial error. I assume that's
right.
Your position. Judge Nettesheim wrote an opinion that raised questions about a line of cases, probably all the cases decided that relate to the Whitting rule or the other act's evidence. What kind of opinion, if we would support you, your position, do you expect this court to write? Do you think we have to overrule prior cases? If so, what? Do we have to overrule? What kind of language would we have to overrule, if we have to overrule any? Or do we not have to overrule anything and just apply our cases?
I don't think any cases have to be overruled. I think that the line of cases to which Judge Nettesheim was referring, as I indicated before, all arose in the context of sexual assaults of children. And in those cases, this court has always adopted a greater latitude of proof with respect to other acts evidence. I think, to answer your question about what kind of decision should be written, I think the court should clarify for the trial courts and for the appellate courts that this line of cases, Kleinmesser, Friedrich, Fischneck, going back all the way to the Hendrickson case, this line of cases is a very narrow subset of other acts evidence jurisprudence. And the methodology used to arrive at the results that were arrived at in those cases should not be transported into other criminal cases generally. And that's where the confusion has arisen, I believe, particularly since during the last 10 or 15 years, nearly all of the other ex evidence cases that this court has addressed happen to be in the sexual assault context, and I think that's where the confusion has arisen.
They haven't all been sexual assault cases. Evers was not, but you might argue that that can be distinguished. I think that if you went through all the cases, and I have not, that you'd find maybe at least two different approaches in the cases. One approach would be that really applying Witte and following Witte, which I gather you accept.
Exactly.
But being, but accepting evidence that may be a little older and maybe a little less like the crime in issue. I mean, Witte was an identification case, the rabbit case. And that's one line of cases, I think. And that may be the sexual assault cases. And then you have another line of cases, I think you're going to find, that have very broad definitions of the magic words, scheme or intent, plan, motive, etc. And in those cases, the dissent or concurrence, depending on what is complaining, that the definition of those words amount to propensity. So, I mean, those are two different kinds of cases you got.
I agree completely.
Well, I don't see how, then, you could say we can live with the second line of cases when they, if you accept this hypothesis, and you don't have to, those cases have redefined plan, have redefined intent, so that it's really a propensity.
Well, I acknowledge I don't agree with the results in those cases. I'd like to see them overruled, but it's not necessary to my position. I don't believe to have them overruled now. And the reason I say that is that I think that that second line of cases that you've identified, where the court, you know, is essentially allowing what is, for all practical purposes, propensity evidence to come in, that those were, as far as I know, all of them were sexual assault cases. And you know, Plymouth and Friedrich were the primary cases that Judge Nettesheim was relying on. Those
say that the court should just say all those cases that define these words in the statute are only for sexual assault cases, and otherwise we define those words differently for non-sexual assault cases.
Well, you know, I wouldn't advocate different treatment. I mean, if I were representing a sexual assault client today, I would not advocate different treatment for different types of crimes, but I think that is a way to distinguish those two lines of cases.
Oh, are you done? Let me ask you, I mean, I think that this is, from a trial court standpoint, maybe from a lawyer's standpoint, one of the toughest areas in evidence. And I think that one of the difficulties is the lack of everybody who's involved sort of doing a critical analysis of you know, you can throw in the kitchen sink, which looks a little bit like what happened here, or analysis. And my question to you is what kind of analysis went on either by the state, the court, or even the defense arguing how, you know, how is this evidence going to show intent? How is this evidence, I mean, did the judge ask any questions? Did the state present any arguments? Did the defense argue about it? Is there anything in the record that sort of shows us what it is? Because I think that, you know, when you do that, at least you can have an analysis of what's at issue.
The trial court went through very little analysis. There was no mention of the doctrine of chances, for instance. There was no mention of case law. The trial court's analysis seemed to hinge on two things. One, there was a similarity, a superficial, generic similarity between the two incidents, because in both cases it involved an argument with a woman and Mr. Sullivan was intoxicated. The second thing was, and this is a bit more troubling, I think, is that the trial court seemed to be suggesting, and the suggestion had been made by the district attorney, that this evidence ought to come in because it's somehow unfair to the prosecution that Ms. Bonham had recanted her accusations, and therefore the state was at a disadvantage in this prosecution. So so we should apply the rules a little bit more liberally to even out the playing field. And I think that's a very dangerous proposition.
But the defense, and I'm not saying that it's defense burden, but the defense point out the difficulty with admissibility of this evidence to prove it was planned. I mean, go through the whole list. I mean, was there any
yes.
argument, and what was the response to that?
I believe that the defense argued throughout in his brief and also in the motion hearing that, look, this is just propensity evidence. This doesn't fit under any of the exceptions. It doesn't show intent. The fact that somebody yells at his ex-wife 2 years ago doesn't mean that he hit his girlfriend today.
Was there any response on how that showed intent, or how that showed?
No. I can refer the court to the trial court's ruling. I believe it's in the appendix to my brief.
I just wonder if there was something else.
Yeah, there wasn't, and that is part of the problem. I think that the trial courts, as you say, have a big problem with this because so often the prosecutor is not making a very specific argument about how the evidence specifically shows intent or motive. It's just a general reliance on, well, these incidents are similar, therefore it comes in. And I think part of that confusion is attributable to the line of cases to which Chief Justice Abramson was...
Mr. Phillips, it's my understanding that the trial court was asked to admit 10 instances, and that what the trial court did was allow just one. Now, in looking at the other 9, did the trial court indicate why that evidence was not going to be admissible and this evidence was?
Well, it made an effort at doing that. I frankly didn't see much of the distinction. I can tell you what the other 9 instances were. They were mainly violations of the no contact order that arose because of the incident with Ruth Sullivan resulted in him getting arrested and a no contact order being imposed. After that, he made calls to her house. He followed her home from work. He was going through a divorce with her. He went over to her lawyer's office and yelled at him one day. One of the incidents didn't even involve his ex-wife, but it involved his employer when he got mad at his employer for firing him. So these incidents were even more removed than the one that was allowed in. None of them involved any kind of physical threats. But, of course, the one that was allowed in didn't involve any physical violence at all. I mean, that's the distinguishing factor between the prior incident and the charged offense, is that there were no injuries suffered. There wasn't even any physical contact with Ruth Sullivan.
Did it, counsel, have any difference in time? In other words, was this the last incident of the 10? I didn't read the transcript, so I wasn't...
No, actually, I believe this may have been the earliest.
Well, it would be the basis for the no-contact order, so it would be the
right,
first
incident. Right, and like I say, of the 9, approximately 4 or 5 were violations of a no-contact order, and the rest of them were just general, you know, he was drunk and yelled at somebody type incidents. I see that my light is on. I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
You will reserve. It's already been reserved. You may speak until the red light goes on, and I would guess you have about 4 minutes.
Okay.
Roughly. But you needn't speak.
Well, it's hard to shut me up sometimes, so I'll continue to speak. I think I'd like to distinguish between the type of incident or the type of incident which might be allowed under the intent exception and the one that we have here. And what we have here is dissimilar, as I indicated, because we don't have any physical contact with Ruth Sullivan. We don't have any injuries suffered by her. And that's why you can't draw the inference from the prior incident that Mr. Sullivan intended anything with respect to Diane Bonham. Second, I would like to point out that throughout this case, the district attorney made no bones about how this evidence was being used. He gave lip service to some of the exceptions in 904.04 too. But as I quoted in my brief, in his motion asking that this evidence be admitted, in the motion hearing, in his opening statements to the jury, in his closing argument, in his rebuttal argument, he repeatedly said, this is why I'm using this. This shows what kind of person Kevin Sullivan is. He's the kind of person who domineers women, who won't take no for an answer. He won't let women tell him what to do. He controls them. He yells at them. He calls them names. He threatens them. Mr. Sullivan wasn't being charged with being a bad person with respect to women. He was being charged with hitting a woman. And that's what he was convicted of. And this is the classic example of an improper use of other acts evidence.
Counsel, thank you. You will have time for rebuttal. Mr. Wolford, Assistant Attorney General representing the state.
May it please the court. My name is William C. Wolford, Assistant Attorney General. I'm representing the state in this appeal. In October of 1994, the victim in this case drove to an American Legion post in the middle of the night and reported that she'd been battered by the defendant at her residence. The police were called, and when they responded, she repeated that story to the officer. However, the victim changed her story at the preliminary hearing, and she claimed that she had fallen down after she tried to shove the defendant, and she couldn't say whether the defendant had hit her. The prosecutor knew that the state would have to deal with the victim's recantation at trial. Therefore, the prosecutor sought to introduce evidence of a number of other acts involving the defendant on several issues. In a pretrial ruling, the trial court admitted only one of the other acts, an incident in July of 1992 where the defendant, while intoxicated, was at the home of his ex-wife, Ruth Sullivan, and was being loud and refusing to leave until Ruth would speak to him. During that incident, the defendant threatened to beat up Ruth Sullivan. This other act's evidence was admitted at trial on the issues of intent and absence of accident, knowledge, motive, and credibility of the witnesses. The defendant was convicted of disorderly conduct and battery and acquitted of false imprisonment and intimidating a victim. The defendant appealed to the Court of Appeals, and the state was represented in that appeal by the District Attorney's Office. In deciding the defendant's appeal, the Court of Appeals ruled that the other act's evidence was admissible to rebut the defendant's theory of defense, which hinged on the victim's testimony that her injuries were accidental. The Court of Appeals further concluded that Witte is no longer the law in Wisconsin. The court concluded that the other act's evidence showed that when women with whom the defendant has a relationship seek to rebuff the defendant, he has a propensity to react violently when he's intoxicated. The Court of Appeals concluded that this evidence is admissible, whether characterized as evidence of motive, intent, or knowledge. It is the state's position in this appeal that the decision of the Court of Appeals should be reaffirmed. It's further our position that the Court of Appeals did not need to conclude that Witte was no longer the law in order to properly uphold the trial court's discretionary determination to admit this evidence. On appellate review of a discretionary determination, the court should uphold the discretionary determination if there is a reasonable basis for the trial court's determination. As will be discussed, there was a reasonable basis for the trial court's admission. The fact that the trial court only admitted this one incident of the numerous incidents sought to be admitted by the state as other acts evidence is an indication the trial court carefully exercised its discretion in considering this other acts evidence.
You indicated that there were two bases under 90 whatever it is. What are they that he could have admitted it?
We're contending that the evidence was properly admitted for absence of accident and intent, which are related concepts.
And I'm going to ask you the same question that Justice Geske asked Mr. Phillips. She asked, as I understood it, what was the analysis set forth by either the proponent or the opponent of this evidence? And it's a similar kind of question, but I answered as to the case law. If you're going to seek admission of evidence, on other acts. You have to fit it into one of these named categories. And then you have to explain what that named category means. You got to define it, right?
Right.
So, what analysis was there by either the proponent, opponent, or the trial judge to fit in this evidence under absence of accidents or intent? What was the definition of the use of intent?
Well, there was a briefing and an argument, and the court made a ruling on all 10 items, and with respect to the item that it admitted, it admitted it on 5 different criteria, and as far as the two that we're talking about, I believe the state's theory was primarily that there's a recantation here. She's now claiming that he didn't intentionally punch her, or at least I don't know whether this intentionally happened. So it may have been accidental, and we need that evidence because we have to show that in order to prove battery, that the defendant intended to cause bodily harm. Now, the court made a ruling. It did not, as I recall, go into great detail regarding how it was defining the various terms that, you know, under 904.04 paren 2.
But do you agree that Evers is instructive concerning the meaning and scope of these terms, and that following Wigmore, the intent exception is based on the doctrine of chances?
Yes.
Okay. So, but that wasn't mentioned in the
There
trial.
Was no discussion, as I recall, specifically of the doctrine of chances, either by the trial court or in the briefing, at least to my recollection.
Are you done, sir?
Well, I was going to ask if you accept Evers, how do you view that evidence of going to an ex-wife's home when drunk and a threatening battery, how does that increase the likelihood that when a woman is hurt, another woman is hurt, that the defendant struck the woman rather than some other accident happened?
Well, the circumstances were quite similar, even though there was no actual contact in the other act's evidence. The defendant was intoxicated. He was at the home of someone with whom he was or had been romantically involved. He was insisting that he was going to talk to her, and she didn't want to talk to him. He was insisting he was going to stay, and she wanted him to leave. And he threatened, although this was in public, he threatened to take her in the backyard or wanted her to go into the house so that he could beat her up. She didn't do either. He was in public. It didn't happen. So there is a distinction there. But I think that we have one instance. Certainly, if there were more instances of this, the doctrine of chances is says that the probity value is enhanced. But our position is that it does have some probity value that this didn't happen by accident.
Was that really an issue? Was that an issue that was really tried in the case in terms of, because obviously the court has, when evaluating the evidence, first you have to identify for what purpose it's being admitted, and secondly, whether or not that is a relevant issue, a material issue that's being tried. And it was the issue of whether this was accidental versus intentionally an issue that was before the jury.
I think it was, and I was looking during the other argument trying to find the relevant pages to refer you to. This is document 57, page 13. You indicated you were You indicated you were the one that initiated this form of physical behavior by trying to push Mr. Sullivan. When you did that, trying to push Mr. Sullivan, did you make contact with him?
Yes.
Or did you make contact with him? You know, I'm assuming that when I turned around, it was probably the upper part of the chest. Did Mr. Sullivan do anything in response? He put his arm up. Did he strike you in any fashion? As I told before, his arm was cocked up. My arm is going out to strike Mr. Sullivan in the chest. I don't know whether it came back or I hit myself with my hand or whether it was Mr. Sullivan's hand. Yes, there was contact made. And then they go on to
now,
say...
Now, is there any argument, is there any cross-examination by the defense sort of on this theory of accident or any argument during closing arguments? Did they use that in any way? I mean, the state's witness said this, and I assume these are any answers to questions by the state or not.
Yes.
Did the defense use this in any way to put, you know, to say that this, to argue that the state can't prove this for lots of reasons, including that they can't prove that it was an intentional crime because it could have been an accident?
Well, it was referenced in the argument by the defense, and I don't have the site right here, but there was a reference to the fact that the state had to show intent, and there had been testimony about contact, but...
Let me take you through the analysis just for a moment. Your argument is that this was used for intent or lack of accident. You have to look at what the argument is that, all right, so the defendant may have caused this and it may have been accidental. And then the next question, and does it make it more probable that he intentionally hurt her face and her body rather than putting his arm up in a defensive mode while they were having this argument? Because 2 years earlier, when he was with his ex-wife, he threatened to hurt her. What is the probative value that this was not an accident while they were having this physical tussle versus hitting in the fact that he may have threatened his ex-wife 2 years earlier and didn't hurt her?
I think it does have some...
You'd admit it's not the strongest probative weight, would you?
Well, certainly the more instances you have, the stronger the probative value. But she was maintaining that... that she was the aggressor, he was quiet, she didn't even remember him raising his voice, and she was yelling at him, and then indicated that this, and I agree with the counsel for the other side, that there was a lot of inconsistency in her
testimony. One of the problems I have here is it appears to me that what the state's trying to do is not impeach a defendant or a defendant's version of a defense by prior acts, but trying to impeach its own witness by acts of the defendant at a prior time. I mean, it's not the defense that this was accidental. You have the victim saying, well, maybe he accidentally hurt me. And then the state tried to impeach its own witness by prior acts of the defendant. I mean, isn't that what's really happening here? Because
well, to some extent that's true, because the recanting witness was the state's witness, but it is the state's burden to show intent, and certainly, at least implicitly, if not expressly, the defendant was relying on this recantation by the victim as one of the bases to escape a guilty verdict on a battery charge.
The trial court put this in for credibility, too.
Yes.
Whose credibility? The victim's? And the defendant didn't testify, right?
That's correct. The
so
trial court.
The victim's credibility.
The trial court did not really, as I recall, make that clear. But I'm assuming that it was the victim's credibility.
Which,
and we're not contending that that was a proper basis on
the state.
On the appeal.
The state used credibility as one of the basis on which it was trying to have it admitted.
Yes.
So the state argued that it ought to be. The state also argued propensity evidence.
Pardon me?
The state also argued, basically, propensity evidence in as much that this defendant, you know, does this kind of thing. I mean, in fact, at one point, didn't the prosecutor say that he thinks propensity evidence ought to be admitted?
Well, this was in the pretrial rulings. The prosecutor said at one point that was his belief. I think that's pretty much irrelevant because he understood and was trying to get the evidence admitted under the various criteria under 904.04 parent 2 and what his beliefs were about what the law should be. That isn't the reason that he was seeking to have the evidence admitted.
Is credibility a grounds for admission under 904.04 sub 2?
It isn't expressly a ground, but I think it can be under certain circumstances, and I'm assuming, it's not altogether clear, but I'm assuming the district attorney was primarily relying on the greater latitude cases where the court has said...
Yeah, this is not an exhaustive list, right? The court has said
right.
This is not an exhaustive list.
Yeah, but where the court has said that Other acts of evidence can be used to bolster the credibility of a child witness, for instance. So it's, it affects credibility in that way.
Mr. Wolford, did the trial court, in making its pretrial ruling, use the two-step process that we require? In other words, after the court looked at it under 904.04 paren 2, did it also review it under 904.03?
Yes, it did.
Counsel, what do you think the court can do to get counsel in the trial bench to analyze carefully the purpose for which this evidence is introduced? Now, you're up here and you agree that the trial court let in this evidence under, I've lost count, five items. And you also come up here and you say, look, they should have only let it in under really two, but if you analyze it carefully, it's one because they're opposite sides of the same coin.
They're related, yes.
Okay. And I think you also agree that the analysis should have been like Evers, and as Justice Geske pointed out, you have to show, and the Wigmore example is somebody, the defendant shoots a gun.
Right.
And it narrowly misses A while hunting. And the defendant says, hey, it was an accident, you know. Okay, so the second time they're out hunting, the defendant shoots a gun and it hits the arm and says, hey, you know, it was an accident. The third time, you know, you get him in the chest and he says it's an accident. And the theory is that you can show the three incidents within, say, 6 weeks. I'm trying to make it quite clear. Same two people, same gun, same area they're hunting. It's possible the three times the defendant did accidentally shoot at A, right? It's possible. The more times it happens, it's less likely. You know, if I give you 10 incidents, obviously this
right.
guy shouldn't be hunting or A shouldn't be going out with him. But, you know, the more numbers of times, and that's the point, that's the chance incident, right?
Right.
Had this been, so one way of handling it is to analyze it under this theory. And so what you have here is you've got one incident, you got a different, what's the time difference between the two? 92 and?
It's a little over 2 years.
92 and 94. You got two different people, although you can say, as you have tried to do, that they're both romantically involved with him. You got a similarity of intoxication. You got public versus private. You got a threat versus hitting. Right?
Right.
So you got one incident with dissimilarities. So then you're going to say that any time a woman gets hurt, a woman with whom this defendant is romantically involved in, gets hurt while the defendant is intoxicated, increases the likelihood that the defendant is struck. That's what you want us to draw.
I think the court should not take the position that one incident of...
But is that the analysis you want?
Yes.
Okay, go ahead.
I think the court should not take the position that one incident of other acts evidence is never admissible under the doctrine of chances, as seems to be suggested by the defendant. I think that what trial courts should be instructed to do is to use 904.03 to consider the probity value of that evidence and balance it against the unfair prejudice, and in some cases exclude it if the probity value is not that great.
And I don't disagree with that. I think if 2 weeks previously you have the same woman, he's drunk, she's injured under similar kind of circumstances, and then 2 weeks later you got the same thing and she's his accident, raising the question that Justice Geske had, which bothers me, as to whether accident and intent are really an issue here. Aside from that, if they were issues, if we concede that, then I would say maybe one with that strong a relation is enough. I mean, you don't have to hunt with this guy three times.
Yeah, and it's not, of course, being introduced for purposes of identity, where the court has said that you have to have greater similarity. The Clark case that I've cited in my brief involved an absence of accident situation where there are two different women. There's more similarity in some other regards, but certainly doesn't have to be the same person.
Let me ask you about part of the argument of counsel, and I know that apparently the argument itself is not at issue, except that it perhaps sheds some light on the purposes for which at least the state saw this admitted, and I'm reading from the defense briefs on page 9 that quotes the record. First, the defense counsel writes, the prosecutor continued with the theme of talking about the incident. He explained that in the prior incident placed the current charges in context and revealed Sullivan's motives for committing these crimes. Quote, he argued, now what does that tell us about motive? Now, I understand you're not arguing that motive was appropriate for admissibility, but then he says, what does that tell us about intent? What it tells us is that this is an individual who's not going to be told what to do. This is a man who lives a life outside of the norms and rules of society, outside of any control. It tells us volumes about his motivation, about his intent, about his purpose. Now, that's not what you're arguing when you say intent. Your argument is this may have been an act that the victim says this may be an accidental injury versus an intentional injury. It seems to me that this is a propensity argument here, and that this is a man out of control, and that's his intent, is that he goes out there and he batters women. I mean, isn't that argument does not fit your argument? Is that?
No, I don't think it does. So, I think some of the argument there that's quoted in the brief is really in reference to some evidence that he was violating no contact orders after this case was initiated.
Well,
but apart from that, some of that I think does get pretty close to propensity.
My evidence. Concern is the jury is told this is admissible for intent. And maybe, if I accept your argument for a moment, accident versus intentional, maybe it's admissible for that purpose, but they're told it's admissible for intent, and then the prosecutor goes on, what does this tell us about intent? And what he appears to define here is propensity evidence. And so, you know, what's the jury going, you know, we've got this cautionary instruction say only use it for intent, but yet when the argument's made, intent is defined for them. It's not defined for them in the instruction, but it's defined for them in the closing argument as propensity evidence.
I think the cautionary instruction does define intent for them. And
but does it define it the way Wigmore does and Evers does?
It doesn't define it in terms of doctrine of chances, but I mean there is some, as I recall, some definition of intent in the cautionary instruction, and most importantly, the cautionary instruction tells them what that evidence cannot be used for. And this is the whole purpose behind 90404(2). The instruction tells them it cannot be used to show that because you think the person is a bad person that you should convict them.
Let me ask you about that. Do you think, you know, and I certainly as a trial judge gave that instruction many, many times, but if a jury is told, perhaps, that it's admissible on the issue of intent and lack of mistake, but not admissible for these other purposes, maybe they could understand it. But what is the likelihood that if the jury has read the laundry list as they were here, it's not admissible in motive, intent, scheme, and I mean, it's admissible for all these things, and it's not admissible, that there's any hope that they're going to understand what this means, what it's admissible for, and what it's not admissible when they've been given sort of this laundry list of things, which you admit is over-inclusive?
Well, I guess I would say two things in response to that. One, the jury acquitted the defendant on two of the four charges, so it seems to me that the jury was able to garner enough from the cautionary instruction to know what it should and should not do and how the evidence should not be used. with respect to the particular issues that we say that were not a proper basis for admission of that evidence, none of those bases were elements of the crimes of which he was convicted. And if you go back to there's a Court of Appeals case that said that was harmless error in that type of situation. I believe it's the Clark case that cited in my brief. In addition, in the Kleinmesser case, there was instruction on some issues that were ultimately found not to be bases, but the court did not overturn that conviction.
Mr. Wolford, given the fact that there was no objection to the cautionary instruction, even though admittedly it was overbroad, do you think that raises a waiver argument on behalf of the state?
Well, I don't understand the defense to be arguing per se that the instruction was erroneous. So I don't think waiver is actually applicable. I think what they're arguing is that this makes it the fact that the instruction was perhaps improper makes it less likely that the error was harmless, or makes it more likely that it's unfairly prejudicial. I simply responded by saying the fact that they didn't object to the instruction indicates that perhaps they didn't view this to be error at all, or view the error to be very serious.
Mr. Wolford, I've wrestled with this problem for many years, prosecutor and defense attorney on this court. The problem that I've always had is that much of the evidence that shows propensity also shows intent, motive, preparation, plan. At least that's the way it seems to me. And much evidence that shows, and vice versa, much evidence that you can argue shows intent, motive, plan, preparation, can also be argued shows propensity. I almost every case I look at, I can substitute the word propensity for whatever was used to justify its being allowed into evidence. And usually it's more and more anyway, it seems, in the last 15 years is all it's been allowed in. I don't know a way around that. Do you agree that that's a problem, or am I seeing things? But if, in fact, that's a problem, then how do we distinguish between when it can go in and when it can't?
Well, I totally agree with what you're saying, and as you pointed out in Speer, and has been pointed out in many other cases, and indeed the statute itself says this, the fact that the evidence shows a propensity to commit crimes does not mean that the evidence is not admissible if it is being admitted for a proper purpose.
That's the kicker, isn't it?
That's the kicker.
So it's possible that you have propensity evidence that is not admissible, right? Because it doesn't fit any of those elements.
If it doesn't fit any elements, then it is propensity evidence, pure propensity evidence, and then it's not admissible.
But even if it's propensity evidence that fits one of those elements, it is admissible.
That's correct. Let me just say a word about Whitty.
So you can't help me?
I guess not.
Well, haven't you, by saying that it's admissible if it fits the elements? The problem then comes how you define the elements.
Yes, and the fact that it shows propensity doesn't mean that that's necessarily a problem.
The real question is it admissible to show something else?
Right.
That's right.
And the problem has come up in these cases because at the trial, many times, not always, no one analyzes it. It hasn't gone through an intent or absence of a mistake through this chance doctrine. It hasn't been looked at that way.
I agree. The trial courts do not analyze other acts' evidence as carefully as
well, what plan means or motive means. Do you think the court's consistent in defining those terms?
Pardon me?
Do you think the court has been consistent in defining those terms in the cases?
Well, I think they've been inconsistent to some extent when they're dealing with a greater latitude rule. But this is not a case where the greater latitude rule is applicable, so I don't think...
No, I asked you in terms of defining intent or defining plan or defining motive.
I think they've been generally consistent outside the cases dealing with greater latitude. I think that they've defined them differently in some of those cases. As far as Witte is concerned, it's our position that Witte is still the law and that this court doesn't need to deal with Witte in order to decide this case. But I'm interpreting the language in Witte that the Court of Appeals referred to about using evidence or other acts sparingly and only when reasonably necessary, and that its use will normally be a calculated risk. It's just a common sense observation that a prosecutor who uses other acts evidence when it's really not needed in the case is running a risk. And I don't interpret it to mean that the court should have a predisposition to exclude such evidence. If that's what it means, then I think it is inconsistent with Speer, and it perhaps a clarification is in order. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Phillips?
I'd like to begin by taking a crack at Justice Babich's question. I think that, you know, in the 300 years of experience that we've had with the rule against propensity evidence, that there has developed a methodology for determining whether something is being offered for a permissible purpose. And with the intent exception, you know, that methodology is the doctrine of chances. With other exceptions, motive and so forth, I've discussed in the brief, there is a way to determine, is this really being offered to prove motive, or is it being offered to prove simply that this is the kind of guy that the defendant is? And, you know, there are appropriate instances where other acts evidence does come in to establish something that's permissible other than the defendant's character. And I think the case law generally establishes that methodology. I think there have been some cases that haven't followed that methodology as closely, and those are the cases to which Chief Justice Abrahamson referred before. With respect to Justice Geske's questions about the prosecutor's argument, I think it's worth noting here, just as an aside, that this happens to be the same prosecutor who was involved in making an almost identical argument in the Jackson case that was argued 2 days ago in this court.
You're not using other acts here. Are you showing up?
You mean the one who's not employed here anymore?
I'll take that back. I would like to follow up on the examples offered by Chief Justice Abrahamson on when the intent exception perhaps would apply in a case like this. And I would agree that if Diane Bonham had suffered injuries similar to this a week ago or a month ago, or you know, there had been a string of six girlfriends and ex-wives that had all suffered injuries within a short period of time, it'd be a very difficult argument.
Well, let me turn it. It seems to me what might have worked is that this victim has been beaten up 10 times by people, and each and every time she claims it's an accident later on. And then they use the prior incidences of her being beaten and saying it's an accident to show that...
Well, if those incidents didn't involve Mr. Sullivan, I think there'd be a problem. If they did involve Mr. Sullivan, you know, I wouldn't be here.
You don't care if it doesn't involve Mr. Sullivan.
No, but that would just show her credibility.
Right.
Not whether or not Sullivan would.
Well, whether she has a plan to come in and each time. I mean,
you know, I think there's another way of looking at this, too, that I'm not arguing that it would necessarily have to be a series of incidents. I think it depends on the nature of the injuries. I think I gave the example in either my main brief or the reply brief that if Ruth Sullivan had been pushed out in front of a bus, and then Diane Bonham had claimed that she had, you know, while arguing with Mr. Sullivan, stumbled in front of a bus accidentally, that's such a unique type of incident or a peculiar way of getting hurt that you might be able to say, well, okay, one prior incident might be enough to establish his intent. In this case, you have very generic, ordinary injuries, a punch in the mouth, a swollen cheek. which very well could have been caused accidentally, and it's not at all implausible that that this happened exactly as Diane Bonham testified to.
Counsel, I just don't know enough about evidence law, but what are the limitations about attacking a victim witness's credibility on using collateral issues, collateral evidence?
That's a good question. I don't know if those limitations... Are you suggesting that either side went beyond those limitations in this case?
I'm asking if you got a witness who's lying, or you think they're lying, a victim witness, what can you do to show that they're lying? Can you bring in a lot of other incidents, or is that just... I just don't know the answer.
Well, I think...
I'm just raising that.
I think
usually you use this other character, other acts, evidence to deal with the defendant. Not with a big witness,
right.
But that's okay. You don't
it's
know
not limited to defendants in any way by the
right. Statute. I don't know that there's any different rule for victim witnesses as opposed to any other witness.
Thank you, counsel. We are concluded the Sullivan case, and we stand adjourned until our...